What I want to talk about today is a project that we're doing in Miami for high-risk gay and bisexual men, substance users that also have high levels of sex risk. So the studies, the pilot and the main study that I'll talk about today were funded by NIDA, and I have no conflicts of interest. So since the beginning of the epidemic, there have only been three completed RCTs to test behavioral interventions for substance-using MSM, which is sort of amazing by itself, and one of them was proven efficacious. That was Steve Shaptoe's study of meth users in L.A. Substance-using MSM bear the highest burden of HIV/AIDS in the country. When I tell people that we sort of expect that the number is about 40% by age 40, people are still surprised at that. What we wanted to do in the pilot study was to investigate risk behaviors and serostatus disclosure practices, and in particular look at meanings so that we could sort of get some sort of fresh understanding about where gay men are now, or actually where they were in about 2006. And then to develop and do a pilot trial of a new intervention. So in the formative research, what we really sort of discovered that was new was that we talked to positive and negative gay men. They really had very different understandings of safer sex behaviors, but also of each other, because we've been concentrating a lot of our intervention efforts in the last 10 years on prevention for positives and prevention for negatives, and we haven't really had a dialogue between the two groups. And that we became concerned that serostatus segregated interventions might actually sustain these different norms that the two groups have. And at the same time, as I'll talk about later, in Miami, maybe more so than some other cities, but probably not so much anymore, we have a very highly integrated, ethnically, age, serostatus, integrated sexual culture, so that people are crossing boundaries all the time. And we also, because most of the HIV-positive men that we talked to were really in care, they really are fairly adherent to their medications, even these high-risk men, it became apparent that probably the biggest issue in terms of HIV transmission, in our community at least, is HIV-positive men who don't know that they're positive. So we based our intervention on social public health theory, which recognizes that people absorb new scientific advances into their sexual behaviors and that they develop their understandings of sexual risk and sexual behaviors in conjunction with their social groups that they relate to. We also grounded the intervention in empowerment theory because we really found out how isolated many gay and bisexual men feel even within the gay culture and how isolated they are from the larger social spheres, even that urban areas have to offer. So we wanted to use this intervention not as a don't do drugs, have safe sex kind of an intervention, but as a try to reframe the drug sex scenes that you're concentrating your time on and look outside of that at the broader world and also try to understand sort of your role within that drug sex arena and why it might be that you're participating. So the conceptual model begins with the early life experiences that we're all familiar with considerations about migration. Most gay and bisexual men move at some point to some urban area to be able to find camaraderie, to find sex, to find friendship, to get away from sort of the oppression that they grew up with. But many times we don't really understand at that time that we're making that decision that we're also, there are costs involved, so that there's lost social capital. There's lost social norms, actually, because gay cultures inside of gay cities have different norms than most of us grew up with, and lost relationships with people who, however oppressive they may have been, cared about you and were concerned. Now, this may be a Miami take, but what we found when we talked to gay men who had been in the South Florida, because Fort Lauderdale is included in this, South Florida includes Fort Lauderdale and Miami, which are about 20 minutes apart, we found that a lot of men who were in these drug and sex scenes really were struggling with what they found there, that it wasn't what they were hoping what they would find there, that they didn't find friendships so easily to find, they found sex easy to find, and that there was a lot of competition around body image, around muscularity, so forth, a lot of hypersexuality, and limited social networks. And then in our conceptual model, this is sort of the life course path to problem health behaviors and to bad health outcomes. So this is the model that we use to develop the intervention. And then focusing now on the right-hand side, what we really wanted to do with the intervention was to have men broaden their social networks, increase their perceived control over how they participate in drug and sex scenes. We did not try to have people come to a consensus about what kind of sex is safe, about what kind of drugs are okay. We wanted them to become sort of consciously aware of how things worked in the scenes that they were in and why they were choosing to be in them. Active versus escape coping, increased social diagnostic skills, awareness of what they were doing and why, and reduced anxiety and depression. We thought that if we moved guys sort of into that sort of new goal setting, expand your horizons kind of realm, that the better health outcomes would come along. So we had four group sessions followed by an individual session. And what we were really trying to do in the groups was to have men talk across all these boundaries. We did 18 years old to 55, black, Latino, white, and both zero statuses and about equal numbers. And to have them develop through this dialogue in groups critical awareness of the scene that they were in and strengths-based repositioning of the fast lane scene and their relationship to it. And then also trying to do some goal setting. What is it that I wanted to do with my life a long time ago that sort of got lost in this transition that I was doing? So in the pilot field trial, again, we had, these were our eligibility parameters, drug use 3 times in the past 90 days, and at least some sex risk current past 90 days. And in the pilot, which was a test-retest design, so we just did baseline, intervention, and reassessment at 3 months. So they were each having about 13 different partners in the last 90 days, and each engaging in unprotected anal intercourse about 17 times in the last 90 days. So these were, even though we only required once as an entry eligibility requirement, they were very sexually active guys. They were high all day for 21 days out of the last 90 at baseline, high sexual compulsivity scores, and high levels of depressive symptoms. This would be definitely, this 3.9 on the depressive scale is definitely in the clinical significant range. At the 3-month follow-up, you can see that we had good effect sizes, again, just test retest design, good effect sizes on every one of these measures. Especially by behavioral intervention standards, these effect sizes are pretty strong. And again, with this population, almost all of us know we're looking for risk reduction and not risk elimination. We had great session attendance. We had 54% of the men report no unprotected anal intercourse at follow-up, which was somewhat surprising, and no differences by serostatus, ethnicity, or age. So then we, based on those findings, we wrote this into a 5-year, much larger clinical trial, and I just want to explain or show you sort of the people who are in the study, who comes, because I'll have efficacy data later on in 2011 from this particular study. But again, the context is Miami, so it's very ethnically diverse, especially on the gay and bisexual sexual scenes. Men tend to cross all of the demographic and serostatus boundaries fairly quickly. And also keep in mind that this is not a don't do sex and don't do drugs kind of an intervention. So the median age is 38, or we're fully recruited at this point with 517 men. Good education levels, high school plus 2 on average, which means we have a lot of college graduates, but look at the income numbers. This, I have to say, might also be a little bit of a function of South Florida, where we have a lot of tourist-related, low-paying businesses, but we also had a lot of HIV-positive men who were on disability from the early days when that was still possible. And sadly, I think, it's very difficult to convince those men, even when they become fairly healthy and able to work, that it would be a good idea actually to get off of the disability. It's really a security blanket for them. You can see the ethnic mix. Fort Lauderdale is much more Anglo than Miami is, so you see sort of a mixture of the two counties. You can look at the victimization histories. If you know all of the syndemic literature, this isn't particularly surprising, although I thought attacked with a weapon was pretty high compared to what I would have expected. That's fairly severe. And lots of sexual abuse, lots of people abused before age 18. These are definitely multi-drug users. A little bit difference in terms of cities. Fort Lauderdale is known as a heavy alcohol town, and Miami is known as a heavy cocaine town. And those stereotypes seem to continue year after year. I don't know why. But anyway, in both cities and across all age ranges, everybody was using more than one thing. But the cocaine popularity does show up with respect to South Florida more than methamphetamine does, although actually 26% current methamphetamine users is a fairly high number. Ecstasy, as you can see, is a passe drug. Again, we're getting about the same numbers in this sample in terms of sexual risk behaviors as we did in the pilot. So that's encouraging to me that actually the eligibility criteria that we used in the pilot made sense. We're getting the high-risk men that we're looking for. Higher numbers of men having sex with women than I would have expected, although we do see a lot, especially in the Black and Latin communities, men having not wanting to necessarily be gay. Using sex to cope is almost a universal in this population. And as I said, we'll have the results after. But to summarize, men with high levels of sexual risk, it's not really necessarily the thing that's going on underneath everything, because there's underlying lots of mental health problems, sexual compulsivity, lots of victimization in their histories, and high degrees of drug dependence. So the sex risk, to me, is something of a symptom more than sort of the real target of the intervention. Social isolation is really high, even though these men seem like they would be out and about. A lot of times they really sort of change their computers at home until the opportunity arises to socialize in a drug sex kind of an environment. Re-engaging HIV positive and negative men about stigma, serosata segregation, and safer sex norms really seemed to the guys in the groups to be something new for them and to be meaningful to them. We don't know yet whether that's going to show up in great effect sizes on the outcomes, but we'll find out. They appreciated having a safe space to actually talk to people who actually were like them, which I think drug users always do. And they really appreciated the goal setting sessions and getting away from thinking about safe sex and don't do drugs. We'll see whether the goal setting actually turned out to have a positive effect. And finally, services that are inclusive of diverse gay and bisexual men may help to increase their social engagement and improve their understanding of risk. That's it.